Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts. A semi-regular, very, very semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Breakup Songs with Horns. And it's about, among, I'm sure, what'll be many other things, the ephemeral nature of pop music. And our guest for this episode, which breaks one of our trademark unplanned, unannounced hiatuses, is someone who knows something about ephemeral pop music, Mr. Brooke Pridemore.
Hi.
Hey, it's the second time on here. Is this the second time?
This second time. Yeah, yeah, we were on here last year.
Yeah, we need to do this more often. Maybe when you come back for the later tours this year, which we'll talk about later. So you got some things going on here. You just released an EP, your post-EP, pre-LP, is that right?
Yeah. I just released an EP called Breakup Songs with Horns, which is 10 songs I recorded over the last couple of years that didn't really have a home. And, you know, we're kind of intended to be part of bigger projects that never really got any further. So I kind of cobbled them all together and released. The official cover photo of the is a drawing I did with featuring a picture of Lee Hazelwood. That's on the one. That's the one I kept. Mm. That's the drawing that I kept. And Lee's album 13 was just reissued by Light in the Attic, and they 13 was an album that wasn't supposed to happen. Basically, he wanted to make an album but didn't have anything cooked up for it, so he deleted the vocals that someone else had laid over an album of Lee Hazelwood songs and released it as his own album. It's fascinating.
Wow.
And the product actually includes the original album as it was intended to be heard with the other vocal on it. It's really bizarre. But the LP is the Lee vocal. It's like Lee's disco album. So it's this like he was new to Sweden and he made this like just this bizarre soul funk disco album in all these keys that Lee Hazelwood can't really sing in, and
wow,
and it's one of his more fascinating albums, and I kind of think it's funny that that reissue comes out the same month that this EP of mine comes out, because it was just like, well, I've recorded this other new album that I want to put more attention into and find a way to get out there, but I got to get these songs out somehow. And so I issued this EP is available on the backs of framed drawings that I've done over the last 6 months. On my last tour, I started drawing out of just general boredom and also like existential dread. People were dying over the summer, and 2016 was rough for everybody. And so it's this like really strange collection of songs in a really strange format for me, you know. So it's, yeah, that's what I'm here for. And it's called Breakup Songs with Horns because none of the songs on it are breakup songs, and none of the songs have horns on them.
That's great. I was wondering because I was trying to think. No, that's Brooke being Brooke.
It was one of those. It was one of the working titles for this other new album that I'm just done with. That like one, another one was Will Always Be Hip. Like Brooke Pridemore will always be hip. And then I came up with the title that I like, but much better than all the rest for this new album. That this EP was also almost called Automatic for the Lonely Hearts Club Band, the dirty version.
Yeah. That's great. So, I mean, you've just unpacked these big things that I want to talk to you about now. Okay. As your maybe philosophy of, or your aesthetic philosophy, if we want to even, you know, use those hoity-toity kind of words. But this notion, there's a couple of things. One for me is there's this notion of authorship and ownership. And, you know, it's the Lee Hazelwood record that's not a Lee Hazelwood record.
Right.
And I struggle with this myself in my life as a poet or whatever. There's this thing that is this thing that I do, but, you know, seeing the aesthetic difference in your own children and your own creation.
Sure.
And saying, you know, that one gets the Brooke Pridemore stamp of approval.
Right.
and this belongs as part of a whole unit. And just the thought process that goes into determining, you know, what makes this, you know, my aesthetic, my thing, versus a happy accident, versus, you know, something that just gets lost on a, you know, on a hard drive somewhere, I guess, because that's how we record right. now digitally.
Right.
You know, and what, you know, or at least thinking like this thing, which is the maybe a song from the Land of Misfit Toys, still has maybe some agency or some almost like human rights or something, dignity right. to it, right, that right, you're right. like, no, this has to be in the world, but I can't make it my normal thing.
Right.
You know, I mean, the Lee Hazelwood story is for me, is just, you know, was he just, yeah, he was just lost and messed up. I mean, there's that great story about the poet Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who he wrote a book of love poems for his girlfriend, and his girlfriend died. Fast forward 10 years. Well, he buried the only copy of the manuscript with her. So, of course, what happens 10 years later, and he had, you know, substance abuse issues, or the kind of substance abuse issues you could have in the 19th century England, and he needed money, and he remembered he wrote all these love poems, so, yeah.
Wow.
They dug her up to get the book back.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Whoa. So, maybe not as... extreme. This is just, you know, Pro Tools, right?
Right. Wow.
Bouncing stuff out of Pro Tools, right?
I was going to launch into a story about the Insane Clown Posse. I didn't know we were going that dark already.
Sorry. Well, you know, we could go from Rossetti to horror rap. It's cool.
I don't know if you know that what I was going to say about, like, when we were talking on the drive over here about the fickle nature of pop music fans versus, yeah. You know, like the literary world, which like kind of moves at a much slower pace. Have a seat.
Did you lose your coffee? What?
Yeah, I don't know what to do with it.
Sorry, we've just been joined by also Justin Brody. Oh, it's under your chair. Oh, look at that. Sorry.
Speaking of the impermanent nature of things.
Yeah, sorry. It's happy accident. This will always be remembered. Remember that time Justin lost his coffee during the podcast? There it is.
So I have decided to take it upon myself. And this will also tie into what we were talking about, the, you know, the very personal nature of records and stuff. I write a column, and it's kind of been on hold for a minute. I write this column that I want to dedicate however many weeks to serious critical analysis of every Insane Clown Posse release.
That sounds fantastic.
And starting at Carnival of Carnage, which is the first Joker's card, and going through until it may only be the first half dozen, but it may also go right up to date. It's really funny to live in a where I live is, you know, everybody considers themselves very open-minded and very, very interested in all kinds of experience and all kinds of humanity, and then to say I'm a fan of this, you know, this group. And I said that to somebody, and they were like, a couple months ago, and they were like, I just instantly lost all respect for you. And I went, and this is the first time I've ever said this. I said, that would mean to me that you did not have much respect for me to begin with, if that's all it took. Like, 'cause that's not nowhere near the worst thing about me. But what I've been reading up about in preparation to get, because I don't want to just do this like diary of, you know, I grew up in Detroit in the mid 90s and there was no act saying it was cool to be from Detroit. You know, we didn't know the Stooges. We didn't know the MC5. You didn't know the cool garage rock bands like the Gories that were happening at the time. Yeah. In middle school, I don't know that stuff. I would find out about it later. And then out of nowhere, this group comes around with this kind of funny, super weird rap albums about killing bigots and stuff, you know, and all under the guise of being these immortal messenger clowns from this thing called the Dark Carnival. And the Dark Carnival turns out is analogous for God. And like their mythologizing of Detroit as this, like, You know, it's not too far off from the industrial wasteland that it is. You know,
yeah.
When they talk, I didn't know Zug Island was a real place until about a month ago, but they talked about it all the time, you know.
Wow.
So, but what I'm finding out is one of their bits of strategy was they did, you know, the albums, which they called the Joker's Cards, and then they would do these EPs. And it was like there was the Carnival of Carnage, and then was the first album, and then there was an EP called Beverly Kills 50187. And it's like just this standalone, non-part of the mythology, just like seven rap songs. And then they did The Ringmaster, which is another... so they did these stopgaps that were intended to... So if they did an album every other year, on the odd years, they would do these EPs that kept fans engaged and kept new people coming to shows.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating. Because I went... How long did I go? I released an album called A Brighter Light in 2009. The rigorous touring after A Brighter Light for about 15 months almost killed me.
Mm.
I stopped touring in 2010. I stopped doing anything, really. I recorded an album called Gory Details in 2011, and then went through 4 years of, am I going to release this album? Am I going to just try to be a normal person? Am I going to go back to school? I was going to get married for a minute. I was going to do all kinds of stuff. And then somewhere in there started writing songs again, and then figured out that it was time to get back out on the road again and start trying to do... you know, start trying to do the right thing around this music. But I have now this complicated timeline where I released in 2015 an album I recorded in 2011. And then, you know, and that's not, and I started writing in 2009, which is not representative of who I am and what I believe yeah. really today. It's a yeah. good album. I'm glad yeah. it's made,
yeah.
but it's not what I wake up thinking about. I mean, yeah. it's an album of girl songs, and I yeah. don't, you know, I don't really go out of my way obsessing about, you know, that particular person as much yeah. anymore, or those people as much anymore. Yeah. And, you know, so then I had all this stuff backed up, and it's like, well, I got to record that. I want to record this new album, but I also didn't want to self-release this new album because I know exactly, you know, I know I can affect 1,000 people if I self-release my own album.
Yeah.
But what could happen if, with my work ethic and someone else to work the record, what would happen if I took it, you know, could take it onto a little bit bigger playing field?
Yeah.
And so we're figuring that stuff out, and I have, thankfully, I have management now. And so the thing that we came up with was, like, let's put this, like, Incesticide kind of tape okay. out there, and just, like... or this it turned out to be a picture, and just like, not really push it, but just be like, here's
the thing.
You know, it's half covers. I only wrote half the songs on it, and it's weird, and it was recorded by two different engineers at five different sessions with two wow. different lineups, and it was not by any means recorded in one room in one go. And it was, so it's just this kind of really weird thrown together. And there's all kinds of voices on it, and there's all kinds of, like, you know, it's got really the pedal stuff that I'm doing now yeah. in effect for the first time. And, like, some really, like, you know, it's kind of this weird thing that it's like, just throw it out there in the world and see what happens. And hopefully keep that, you know, not that I hate to say brand, but, like, at least, like, that
name. Let people know you're there, the you know. Room. And
yeah.
I get that. I mean, you know, it's funny you should say that because I got the opportunity once to meet one of my, like, teen musical idols, the Canadian singer-songwriter Hayden. I don't know if you're familiar
yeah.
with him.
Girl yeah. of my dreams.
Yes. Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, I'm from Detroit, so Windsor Punk
oh,
Radio.
Oh, that's right. So you're totally
right
on
the water. 89X.
So, yeah, and so he was opening for this band that I didn't care about, and he was just working his own merch table. Like, he played his set. I drove to Cleveland to hear him play for about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, he's just sitting there by his merch, just sitting there. We were like, you know, had that almost weird moment, like, can we go talk to him? You know,
yeah,
I
yeah.
like, Mr. Hayden.
Was
you know,
nice?
That kind of geek love moment. But in the course of that conversation, he said, and the friend I was with at the time, hanging out, was going through a breakup, like a really terrible breakup. and the album, it was the Hayden album, Hey Love,
yeah,
which has all of these like different takes on love. It's about his daughter is non-vocal. Mm. She has this, you know, auditory processing disorder, and so she's like six and hasn't said a word yet. And, you know, that's their first child, and this kids put a strain on a marriage anyway, and then thing. And so there's all these ways to think about love and heartbreak. Okay. And my friend was like, man, you know, whatever you went through during this record, it just really hit me, you know, thing. And he said, yeah, well, you know, you're welcome. I had to hurry up and get it out because I'm over most of that stuff already. And he had then said that he had recorded, there are two Hayden albums locked in the vault that were about whatever he was going through at that moment. And by the time it was time to finish mastering the record and tour on it and shoot videos, he just wasn't feeling it anymore. And so he's like, nah, we're not going to do those 10 songs or whatever. You know, which is like as an extreme version of it. But yeah, I'm sure, yeah, yeah. Was that for you like, you know, you had this stuff. And again, it's like, does the stuff almost like... Because you wrote it, because you recorded it, are you feeling now almost like a stewardship of it? Maybe is that another way of thinking about the Brooke Pride more? If we don't want to think about branding, is it that I created this thing and it's like now I'm almost like I'm responsible for it?
Well, if you are riding on, I'm really riding on this idea that right after I quit the road for a while, a few months later. I'm at this function, and this guy, I'm just getting to know all these people. I'm at this thing, and this guy goes, "Oh, you got to meet my friend Scott. Scott's in the band too," and I go, "Oh, cool. Every fucking buddy at this shit is in a band, you know? Like, who cares?" He takes me over and he introduces me to this guy Scott, Oh, I go, "Oh, cool, you're in a band. What band are you in?" And he goes, "Real Big Fish." And I was like, "Oh, that's a band. That's you're really in a band." You know, and he was like the last original member besides the singer who was just about to leave the band. Mm. He was he said to me, you know, dogs could tell I was not in a good space in 2010, you know, was, things were bad.
Yeah.
And he said to me, you know, you may not be an artist again. You may not be an artist. You may not write any more songs. He said, you'll learn to be happy doing whatever it is that you are guided to do. And he said, and even if you do write songs, the kicker will be you'll realize that you're not even the songwriter. You are the vessel for the voice of something bigger than you that's using you.
Mm.
And so, you know, really, cosmically speaking, not that much time later, I started to write songs again. And then it really has been like that. There has been less of this, fuck yeah, let me go wow everybody with this new song. And it's all become like, let me go try this song out in front of people in case it's terrible. And I'll be literally just terrified. All the material on the new record that we just recorded, and really the original songs on this new EP it was the same thing. It was like, I think I have to go check this stuff out in front of people to make sure it's even palatable. Because it's vastly different. I mean, it's all in English and it's all played on the guitar. And it's all, you know, snotty in a way and kind of hyper-literate, but hopefully not annoyingly hyper-literate. But, you know, it's a lot different internally than the material that I was doing before the wheels came off. And so... there has been this a couple of years ago when I was going to bag this whole thing and just, you know, I don't know what I was. There was a while I wanted to buy a house. There was a while I wanted to be a, you know, any number of things. And, you know, I was like, but you got this material coming out of you that is not yours and deserves to be taken to some kind of audience. And if, you know, if you are if we're on the same wavelength, I kind of believe that, like, if you act as if you are trying to live a better life, the universe has a way of conspiring in your favor.
Yeah.
And it's suddenly, like, it was really hard to book shows at first, and then it's like, it got really, really easy. It's been gotten easier and easier with each going out to, like, find places to play and people that not only want to help but have been waiting for the opportunity to be helpful for a lot of years.
Yeah, which I think is, I mean, that's got to be a wondrously, like, humbling but also enriching thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel you, because I had some similar struggles with my own creative process, where it was sort of like, I better murder it, you know, it's like, this is it, you know, if we don't, you know, it's last game of the World Series, two out, I'm at the plate, you know, right, kind of right, like, right. And you're always putting this weird, undue fucking pressure on yourself.
Right.
That could just crush somebody, or you just end up being so muscle-bound, you know, if it's not perfect at the end, how can you even start?
Right, right.
You know, I mean, I teach writing, and I have had that. I've had students that have had that same, you know, and trying to talk to them out of, like, no, you just got to make something, and then you can make something else. But you got to make the thing first, and then make it what you want it to be, or make something else, as opposed to this undue, yeah, pressure of, I better, yeah, I'm going to murder it, I'm going to kill these people, this is going to be the greatest thing ever, yeah, versus, you know, letting the thing guide what it becomes. And you just sort of be the instrument, which then does allow you to go back to this Lee Hazelwood story. This notion of, you know, for you, is there a somewhere floating in outer space, the perfect Brooke Pridemore song? Or a sense of, like, this is what I want to do. And it's a matter of just figuring out getting to that. I don't want to say Platonic ideal, but, you know, there's lots of philosophy books in this room. And there's Plato right there behind Clifford. So he's right there, bottom, second to bottom shelf. And past Clifford, there's Plato, right? Is there some sort of ideal Brooke Pridemore song floating in outer space, and you just try to,
you know,
reach that? Or is it more of, like...
You know, I try as I ever have wanted to, you know, somebody years ago, my buddy Dan Costello, well, we were roommates, and he's on one of my old albums, and we were in his band together, and the record that we made of his together was called Costello, and he wrote a song for me to sing on that album, and it's called Breakup Song for Brooke Pridemore to Sing, and it is as close to, it has every trope of one of my songs from the day in it. I mean, so long term, I have this project called The Book of Pridemore, which is this long record. I was misnamed on a marquee once as The Book of Pridemore.
That's great.
But I have this, it's, you know, this B-sides, A-sides, B-sides, kind of weird outtake record that I'm slowly building. And it'll definitely be on that. It's a very good song. But, like, you know, I guess my philosophy has always been, I hate the word philosophy, I guess the belief? Target? The target I'm trying to hit has always been that you're as good as you're the next thing. You know, and so I've always been, you know, I've never really thought about the perfect Brooke Pridemore song, because, right, you know, my first record was intended as a document of the material that I made. It's all material that I wrote before I moved out to the coast. Yeah. And then my second record is the first year that what I spent writing the first year, and then the third record is really like the first 3 years that I was out, and then the fourth is like the subsequent 3 years of really touring, and then the fifth one, and so it's like, you know, and so the author grows, hopefully, chronologically as each record passes.
Yeah.
And hopefully as a player and as a performer and as a singer and instrumentalist and hopefully as a writer, and, you know, hopefully the tastes change over time so the record is that much different than the last one. You know, now I can kind of look back and go, well, the one that I made, the third record, is that's my anti-folk record. And the fourth record is one, the one where I was clearly over-listening to the Mountain Goats. And I do, like, regret, like, the dick biting that I did on that record, definitely. Not that I don't like that band, but...
Yeah.
And then the fifth record is, like, the emo record, you know. And then the one that I just recorded is, like... the Drag City record, I really think of as like the mid-90s smog kind of sounding record of mine. And then you know, wholeheartedly, I've been saying in front of microphones that, and you can influence, I can influence the writing somewhat by changing what I listen to. I sincerely hope the next record I make is like my like stoner doom metal record. That mm-hmm. like... that I hopefully I can make this like really heavy, still have it be like absolutely recognizable as a record of mine, but make something that's like wholly different than the one before it, and like hopefully a step up, not to render the one before redundant, but to make it. Just to be like, well, then there's the next chapter. Because otherwise you're doing, you know, what did Van Halen do after 1984? You know, Van Halen made a perfect record.
Yeah.
With 1984.
Yeah.
And then contracts were in the way and, you know, bank accounts were in the way and people were working for them and they had to keep making records.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't even like Van Halen that much. Yeah. But you can name any band. Most bands, when they make that perfect record, they stop. You know, and they, you know, Young Marble Giants made one perfect record. Okay. They never made a second one. Neutral Milk Hotel made a perfect record. I hope that, you know, I hear rumor that there's
a third drawing one. Things yep. and yeah, the clues and keys in there. Yeah.
But the friend of mine that produced my new record is friends with all of them. And he said, it's all baloney. It's all just rumors.
Oh,
he's friends with those guys. And, you know, so... But I mean, like, you know, you make this thing that's perfect. You know, I think in Nirvana's mind, In Utero is a perfect record. I think in Kurt Cobain's mind, In Utero was his master statement. And then to try to write songs after that, you know, was what do you...
Probably,
you
know? Yeah.
I joked last night that if I met Jeff Mangum on the street, I'd ask him how Anne Frank was. Or I joked earlier today.
Yes.
You know, I wouldn't know what else to say to him, you know.
Yeah.
How's your relationship with Anne?
Yeah. Yeah. See, I was still asking the Zizek question.
Yeah.
Hey, did you ever have dinner with that guy? What's he like, you know?
is Zizek still alive?
Zizek is still alive and being controversial and trying to explore why humanity is so screwed up these days. And Jeff Mangum's wife, Astra Taylor, did a documentary about him. And so I would think there was at least one dinner.
Oh, yeah, there had to be.
At least once.
Bill Callahan married his documentarian.
That's a level of intimacy. Yeah. Bless you.
She shot the
that's right.
She shot the tour documentary on the Apocalypse tour.
That's right.
Which I still have never seen. And he's married to her now.
But I get what you mean, that this idea of the perfect record. I mean, is it also then too, do you just paint yourself in a corner? If you reach perfection,
right.
Is perfection a kind of a death? Whereas exploration, and you know, it's funny now you say that too about the doom metal thing. The last podcast you were on, I said, oh, we have to talk about your live show. We never did.
Yeah. So we should talk about that now, huh?
Yes. Years later, let's talk about, like, because that was the thing for me, is you were doing a thing, and the thing itself was compelling. You know, it's like, hey, you know, if I've seen 10 people, I have not yet seen 10 people who do the solo acoustic guitar thing well enough to do a top 10 list. When I do, you'll be on that list.
Crazy.
But, you know, in 20 years, I have not seen 10 fuckers who do this well enough that I can say, oh, yeah, the top 10 people. Obviously. And then you then suddenly, you know, hit, like, whatever pedal that was. Like, you got to talk about gear because I'm getting into the world of gear, but maybe not the podcast. And I was like, whoa, he's doing, like, crazy things that that acoustic guitars aren't supposed to be allowed to do.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, just figuring that out. And when did that... When did the big, crazy, loud doom thing enter into your folk world, you know?
Well, to start, for many years, I was on tour, and if I was coming to your house on tour, that meant that I would go in your living room or in your, on the stage in the bar or in the backyard or in the park. I'd stand up on the bench and do, and just yell and go, what are they doing? And just, kind of do, play my songs. And, and so I was, fairly at the time considered part of this thing called folk punk, which there are not a lot of good artists doing that. It's very easy to do.
It's hard to do well.
Yeah.
Abstract expressionism and painting.
Our friend Pat the Bunny was good.
Yeah.
Our friend Eric Peterson from Mischief Brew was good.
Yeah.
Our friends the Ghost Mice were good.
Yeah, they were great.
Every once in a while I see somebody doing what those people were doing, and I go, that is a really good example. There's someone named Apes of the State right now, and what they do is really is along that line, and a few others. But it's really easy, and a lot of people do it.
Yeah.
And what's funny is I have never drawn well, even when I was jumping up on benches and playing like that. I have never drawn well among that audience because I don't dress the part.
Mm.
I don't sing about the things that they're singing about. I'm on a... It's different.
Yeah.
And when I stopped, it was kind of like, well, I really, thankfully, I won't be having to do that anymore. And then when I had enough time, I got a job. I had enough time to, like, delve into... I had enough time to start going to other music in New York and going, what do you like?
Yeah.
Rather than, I got into things like, got way into garage rock and, like, the current wave, like Ty Siegel and the OCs, and, I got way into Jandek for a minute. I don't really think you can impersonate Jandek. It would be really ingenuine to try to impersonate him, I don't know. And you just kind of whittle through everything, and you get through, and I get to a point and I go into that shop. And over the course of time, I was like, I was playing with this band. I'm like, I should get a distortion pedal. You walk into a guitar store. You walk into one of those big corporate ones, and you go, I'm an acoustic guitar player. I need a distortion pedal. And they go, you cannot plug an acoustic guitar through a distortion pedal. They say, you cannot do that. And I say, don't believe me. Just watch.
Yeah.
I literally had a guy say, you cannot do that. It is not possible. The truth is, nobody that works in those shops knows what the fuck they're talking about, because it's just a matter of patience, and it's just a matter of doing doing your research and doing your work and carrying your guitar in there and going, we're going to work this out. What I found is my clean sound that I like is a bass DI box. It's called a Sans amp, and it comes with an overdrive channel, and the overdrive channel is always on. So I start there and then run it through a phaser, and the phaser is always on. And then I've got a number of other pedals, including a fuzz box, which is the second, so I've got the clean channel is already distorted, and then the fuzz box is for the real,
big, explosive.
Because if you've heard a Neutral Milk Hotel record, you know that you can put a distortion pedal on an acoustic guitar. Now, what it turns out is that's a fuzz pedal. It's not a distortion pedal.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a plantain. It's not a banana.
Yeah.
You know, like what, like, I'm not asking for science here, you know.
Yeah.
So it was just a matter of learning. And over time, I learned how to do this stuff. And over time, I find myself drawn to styles of music that I wasn't previously interested in. I walk into that shop and I hear this record called Dope Smoker playing for the first time. And I go, this sounds exactly right. I was working in an office. I was shredding paper. I was just literally sitting over two shredders shredding paper. And so you can't hear a Bob Dylan record in your earbuds when you're shredding paper. You need this brutal, punishing music, you know. And so I buy this record. I bought it on Sativa colored vinyl. Mm-hmm. Which is so lame, but it's like orange and green. It's not, it's not, it would have been better if it had pot leaves on it.
Really.
But so I get really into this, and then, you know, that was around the time my mother and her husband both passed away in 2015, and things get real dark, you know, when you lose somebody that you love, but you really don't like very much.
Yeah.
And so I don't know exactly what put me onto it, but I start getting into this harsh noise. You know, Merzbow and Kevin Drum. And, you know, there's a Kevin Drum record called Sheer Hellish Miasma that whatever you're feeling, it'll literally hit the off button on whatever you're feeling.
Mm.
You know, and you're just like stuck in this thing just going like, whoa. I would really like to make that kind of music at some point.
Yeah.
In a long form. Maybe not live, but maybe just on recording. But what I am finding I can do right now, I have an analog delay pedal. And what I do at the end of the show is now I'm up to 7 pedals. And I get things going, and they're all on. And I've got like an oscillator and a pitch shifter and, you know, 2 levels of tremolo and 2 levels of fuzz. And you get it all going, and then crank the, you know, I just crank the time and the repeat knobs. Because an analog delay pedal starts to decay, and that makes it even cooler.
Yes,
than a digital. So you get things all the way to the right, and then you start fading that time between delays back to the left, and it's really simple, and it's really effective, and people don't see it coming because I'm usually playing these super mournful songs at the end of the set, and then you just go, you just got this like. You've just got this wall of feedback happening, and it's really personally rewarding. It's my way of saying, because now when I write people to play shows, I'm like, listen, like, I know what it looks like. Because today I get emails back from bookers that are like, I don't book folk punk. You know, and that's, you can see the door slam.
Yeah.
You can see the door slam, and the responses come quick enough that you go, like, you can't even say that's not even what I do. You know, it's just been decided that's what you do. You know, Derek doesn't, you know, the Homeless Gospel Choir doesn't have that. Like, people are like, we're booking the Homeless Gospel Choir. We're going to book the best rock bands in town.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're going to book, you know, cool, we're going to book a cool, noisy show. And so I finally, just the last year or so, been going, look, like, if that's the best show that you can put together, then fine. If a couple of guys with acoustic guitars, but that's not my thing.
You know,
I would be happier being the kind of head-scratching 30 minutes on, you know, a stoner metal show or a rap show, or, you know, as long as there's open-minded people there, I'll affect the same number of people in that kind of audience as I will on standing on a park bench being miserable. And I'll be happy because I'll be listening to music that I like, you know. And it's starting to get understood that, like, but then what I get a chance to do is then it's not only justify like my needing to be on these kind of out of the box kind of bookings, but I also get to say, without getting up in front of a microphone and going, I'm really into Kevin Drum and Merzbow and Sun and Ohm and Sleep and, you know, Electric Wizard. I get to get up and make fucked up noise and have it and present my taste that way.
Yeah.
So it becomes more like a, like, okay, let's go out there and actually show it. And every night I get, you know, I don't practice the pedal stuff at home. I just get out there and do it in front of a room full of people.
Oh, wow.
You know? So it's like, you know, somebody didn't see me play for 2 years, and they were like, you've really learned how to manipulate those pedals. And it's like, well, you play 100 shows, you play 100, 120 shows a year and do that stuff every night, like you figure it out, you know?
Yeah, that's all fascinating. So I have to tell you then my Merzbow story.
Okay, yeah, I love it.
The first time I heard Merzbow, I we were talking about this in the car driving over here, how in the early 90s when I came of age, and I think you came of age too, or at least started like perking your ears up and listening to the world of music, you know, Nirvana was this incredible scythe that just blew everything. You know, when I was a kid, New York City did not have a contemporary rock radio station.
Hmm.
There was nothing. There was the classic rock station, 102.5, was it WNEW, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
If they played REM,
it was Superman.
It was Superman, you know, they would get phone calls, and they would put them on the air of like, man, what are you doing? What are you doing? This ain't Zeppelin, man. I didn't tune this station on to listen to this crap, you know, and kind of stuff. And they would make fun of these people who would call and be angry about REM, you know? And there was, you know, Z100, which was what I listened to, like, you know, there was like five rock songs that were allowed.
Right.
And I'll never forget the first time I heard Smells Like Teen Spirit. I remember doing something and I stopped what I was doing and just stared at the radio like, what? Dude. And I didn't even know they didn't announce who it was or what it was. And so I got this window, and then for like 48 hours, I was like, what was that? You know, there was no internet. There was no way to look it up. I didn't have any friends to ask, you know. I just sat there with the station tuned, the radio tuned to the station, and a blank cassette tape in the thing with record pause, and I would just wait. Yeah. And then I was worried I was like stretching out the tape or something. So I'd like hit stop when it was a different song because, oh God, we can't have it on forever, you know. And then I'd record pause again and wait. And anyway, and then there was this incredible, you know, the major label signing frenzy.
Yeah.
You know, where there was anything was fucking possible. And you just heard all these different voices and all these different sounds and all these different aesthetics. And, you know, and it's like it got totally spoiled. And then by the late 90s, it was the Nixons. It's Kevin Mary 3 and those drums bands, you know. And it was so boring. And I remember, honestly, like around the year 2000, thinking, man, what if I heard it all? What if there's nothing else? And it was so depressing and constraining. And I mean, you guys haven't even seen the CD room. There's a CD room in this house. Of like, you've seen the vinyl. There's on this floor, there's a room full of fucking CDs. Because I was always like, it's like those people who go through famine and then they always have 8 bags of rice in their pantry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's, I think, still now the way I approach music and books and all the other shit I have in this house that makes it impossible to move, and hopefully I can die in here and not have to move this shit ever again.
A couple of years ago, I had 8 300 count CD book, 360 count CD books full.
Wow.
And I looked at a lot of it and I went, this is garbage.
Like, yeah.
You know, yeah. A lot of it. For a minute, it was like anytime I'd go into Academy, you know, the Academy in Williamsburg, it's not there anymore. They had, for whatever reason, they had every classic Elvis Costello record on the deluxe edition, like those, like that Queens of the Stone Age record, and I bought all of them.
Wow!
And the kick in the seat is, Elvis Costello's fine. Like, I like him.
Yeah.
I like the very best of Elvis Costello in the Attractions.
Yeah.
There aren't many deep cuts for me. No one's ever, you know, I've never really allowed anyone to try to prove me wrong on that one, but it's like, but I bought 16 Elvis Costello CDs. So I'm sitting there with 32 CDs I've never played and will never play. I'm never get around to.
Yeah.
You know, could die tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, so I bought these jewel cases and I sold them all back, and I started turning like 200-300 CDs into 12 records, you know.
Yeah.
And taking the money and just putting it right back into buying LPs.
Yeah.
And So the collection has gotten a lot smaller, but I live in a small room.
Yeah.
The room is not big. It's a small collection in a small room. You know, what I consider a small collection.
But it's valuable.
Which is probably one of your shelves, one and a half of your shelves downstairs of LPs.
Yeah.
And then a milk crate overstuffed with 7 inches.
Yeah.
Because I do DJ.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's... There's this disposable thing about
pop music.
Yeah, that's just like my dad put it best. He goes, most people only want to hear what's popular, and most people only want to hear what's popular right now.
Yeah.
That the best music
is that,
right.
Or it's, you know, some invisible save point in their past.
Right.
You know, but so I was stuck. I wanted to search things, and a friend of mine from high school came up to visit me here in Pittsburgh, and he had gotten into electronic music.
Huh.
And I was like, oh, well, that's a frontier, that's a thing. And he had one of those CD books that you're talking about.
And
Merzbow Toro Machine was one of them. And I remember saying, what's that? And he's like, oh, it's Japanese noise, it's not for everybody. And I was like, well, can we just check it out? And I forget, this was like February, and I'd been like, it just really weighed on me, and it really depressed the shit out of me for years. Like, it was just like, I thought at the age of then I was probably not yet 25, and like, the life is over, there's nothing. Yeah. You know, and he put that on, and I remember my stereo, the volume knob was a slider, and it was on one. And it was and it just filled the living room, and it was overwhelmingly loud. That first song, "Cannibalism of Machine," if you can even call it a song. Yeah,
it's just like,
and I was just like, shit. And I started getting that like hot tunnel vision feeling. I was like warm and tunnel visiony, and I was like, oh, the god, it was over. And I was like, dog's got to go out. And it was February, and I was just wearing a t-shirt, and I remember. To keep myself, as Cheever was running around in the snow, I went over to my garbage cans and I grabbed a handful of snow and ground it into my bare arms because I just really needed to feel pain, not to fucking pass out. And I remember coming back in, and my buddy Bob was like, man, I know, that's not for everybody. I was like, no, that's the most amazing thing I ever... And we went around town the next day and found that CD. Because I was like, here was like, at least there's something that's so far out there. And it actually allowed me to enjoy some of the shit I was bored with even more. Because I know, well, that's not it.
There's this whole
other world. And it was so liberating, just the idea of noise. You know, and there's that Jacques Attali book, Noise, the Political Economy of Music.
Huh.
Where it's this amazing, he's a French economist who wrote a musicology book.
Oh, I would love to read that.
It's crazy because what he says is, you know, there's noise and then there's music.
Right.
And noise is violence.
Yeah.
And music is just channeled violence, and it is maybe the legitimate use of violence in a culture.
Yeah.
And it made me think about, like, and so he says, you know, there's the things, what's popular now, what's cool now, what's shocking now. You know, he uses the thing, it's like, it's Carnival. It's the Feast of Fools. It's the moment where anything goes. And he says, that inevitably, because that's always Fat Tuesday, inevitably that will turn into Lent. And it'll become the solemn, boring procession, I can't speak, of self-denial.
Crazy.
Yeah, and so that was like, oh, that explains music for me now. But I remember living in Lent for many years. Until I heard Merzbow, and I was like, oh, noise, well, that's...
Huh.
And then I was talking about noise, and one of my grad school professors was like, well, have you read the book Noise? And I was like, no, there's a book called Noise? But yeah, it is that weird thing of, you know, what's popular now, what's cool now, what that box you're talking about, too, folk punk.
Yeah.
It's just, folk punk.
People do it. The last time I was at Fest in Gainesville, which is probably the last time I'll go, it was, I don't know how up on Fest lore you are, but it was a, it was this year, the police were not even trying to, they weren't even trying to break up this party. They were trying to drive down the street on which this party was happening.
Wow.
And these kids were, there's like 300 kids in the middle of the street. The story was Jeff Rosenstock was supposed to play a Blink-182 cover set or something like that. It was pandemonium. And the cops got out of the car. It was one cop car. Two cops got out of the car trying to disperse the crowd. And the kids beat the shit out. And I'm, you know, it's one of those, like, the easy answer is, well, good, because they're fucking cops. But it's like, now hold on, because it's not that simple.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not that. It's not that simple when you're watching it happen.
Yeah.
You know, here's a couple guys that were seemingly getting out of the car trying to go, hey, look, have a good time, but leave the street clear. Like, we're glad you're here. Thanks for boosting our economy. And they got out of the car and got their asses kicked. And it's like, it's not as simple as fuck all cops. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But, like, the next day, there was this kid. And this is another thing that I'm like, I was at this fest going, you know, I ran into this kid. I don't know his name. Everybody called him Johnny the Hobo. Because his name was Johnny and he was from New England. And he really did live that life where it was like he train hopped everywhere and spanged everywhere he went. And seven or eight of the kids in the melee when the other cops showed up got arrested and were in jail the next day. And this kid was going around trying to collect donations for the free the... He had some name. It was a scam. He was trying to get money off people. The free the Gainesville 7 or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And it was really funny because it was... He got into this... I was waiting online to get into this show. And he got into this shouting match with these two, like, for lack of a better term, they were like these D-beat kind of punkers, you know, like, you know, just different worlds, different micro genres in the same umbrella.
Oh my God, yeah.
Umbrella system. And it's, you know, if punkers were ever going to do something where they were all going to get together, you know, the D-beat guys are going to have to get along with the hardcore kids, who are going to have to get along with the peace punks, who are going to have to get along with the folk punks, we're going to have to get along with the crust punks. We're going to have to get along with the oogles. We're going to have to get along with the mall punks. They're all going to have to get together. But everybody likes their one little corner.
Yeah.
And
it's about turf,
this,
too.
This dude, this kid, Johnny the Hobo, he's like, the fight gets to a certain point, and he's like, fuck you, why don't you go do a breakdown? And... And without missing a beat, the guy was like, why don't you go write a folk punk song about it? And I had this moment where I was like, fuck, like, anybody that knows why I'm here puts that kid and me in the same box.
Yeah.
And the kid turned around and looked at me and gave me this shitty look because I didn't jump in and help him.
Oh, God.
And this, like, how could you leave me hanging like this? Look. And I never saw him again after that. He's probably, I mean, you know, thinking of the lifestyle the kid was living, he's probably dead. But, you know, like, I've always been, you know, to kind of, like, take anything you don't understand and shove it into this little box, you know. It's like, how do you describe a Jandek record to somebody? Like, do you, you know?
Yeah.
First of all, I wouldn't recommend it to just anybody.
Yeah.
But even to say it's outsider music is pretty marginalizing. Because it's like... There's some real beauty in that stuff. You know, you just have to be willing to look for it.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to go like, okay, this is going to be weird and kind of uncomfortable. And then there are going to be moments sublime, you know, like,
yeah.
But it's easier to just say, nah, you know, I don't do blank. I don't do blank. You know, we were having conversations about trying to describe what I do and how annoyed I get that I get called folk punk, you know, but it's not exactly punk and it's not exactly anything. And I've never really wanted to fit into any one thing.
Yeah. Which probably in a weird, I mean, that is swimming upstream though, then for you as a career musician or whatever, like how do you, you know, I understand that. And I understand too, though. I mean, we live in this age of mechanical reproduction where do you stand?
Right.
You know, I work with 18-year-olds And I used to make them do intro speeches where they just explained themselves or whatever. And they would hit this point where they were almost like then would apologize for the shitty town they grew up in. Like they would, hi, my name is, and I'm from, and there's a town, a commuter dump north of here called Shaler. And they would just go, hi, I'm from Shaler. Like it was just like, you would just let the wind out of it. Like, yeah. I know we were going to Disney World, but how about just Dairy Queen? Can we just go to Dairy Queen and turn around? I know you wanted to go to Disney today, but Dairy Queen? You know, there's nothing wrong with Dairy Queen, but by comparison, and it's like this whole, and I could see how for people who, MDB or whatever, in Pittsburgh, the Polish Hill scene or whatever.
What's the Polish Hill scene?
It is DB. It is Discharge. Everybody, you know, you got to have a Discharge patch. There's two bars that have the bands. Everybody moved pretty much into that neighborhood that has the two bars.
Got it.
It's fun. I like it. I drop in. I hope they don't think I'm a narc when I go to their shows, you know, because I don't look like them. But it is their own, you know, I mean, they'll even say on the flyers, no pose dogs. You know what I mean? Like, you have to belong here to go here. And it's just like, okay, but, well, I like these bands too. Or something like that. And it's this weird, but it's this weird singular subculture. It's fun to visit, but I don't know if I could ever live there. I don't know if I could ever anymore just say, okay, this is the one band or this is the one music and that's it.
First of all, and it's always with super aggressive, you know, super, you know, in your face, snotty kind of music. Like, what is the guy who only listens to hardcore put on when you're fucking? You know, like, you know, what is the kid who only listens to hardcore put on walking down the aisle at the wedding? You know, like. You're gonna have to listen to the wedding march eventually.
Yeah.
Like you're gonna have to raise a kid, you know, and you're not gonna have, you know, my first Kids Bop sings Reagan Youth. It's just not, they're not gonna make that, you know. It's like, so it's like,
we got those Rockabye Baby CDs.
They do, yeah, but
but I was over it because the producer I was working with has a 2-year-old daughter, and so they have all this kids music. They have all this cool kids music, and it's like, but the one that they had lying around that I dragged them for was Kids Bop or whatever does U2 or like you know, so it's like the baby's version of Where the Streets Have No Name, you know? So it's like, or the baby's version of Stay Far Away So Close.
Wow.
She's by that child is being raised bilingual. And I, being, because the mother is, my friend is French-Canadian, and so she's speaking French, and I put on this kid's version of C'est Plein Pour Moi for her, and she already knew it from having been exposed to it.
Wow.
And she knew the words and everything. It was fucking rad.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it is this hard thing, because you want things to be open, but there has to be rules. There has to be some stuff that just sucks, right?
Yeah.
There just has to be some shit that just sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. The Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Exactly.
Fucking suck. Even they have their moments, though.
Yeah.
I had to make a dividing line a couple years ago. So people are like, what are you into? And it's like, I don't have all night, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I like all music except the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I have a friend who used to tell people, I only like the Weaker Thans. Because it would stop people from trying to talk about music. You know, and so like, you know, so I just go, I like all music except the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and that basically sums it up. I would never, we heard a Chili Peppers song at breakfast today. I would never willingly put on one of their CDs, but you know, if it's on, I'm not going to ask you to change the channel. I might ask you to change the channel if Screwdriver comes on.
Yeah, well, that's ideological, but
right.
Yeah. So I think now is a really good time. We could take a break and actually do a drop-in because we're talking about this thing. It sounds like this thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And so which song on the new EP would you like to listen to?
So I'd like you to put on the song For the Worst of It.
For the Worst of Track 9.
Yeah. Yes. Would you like to know why? I'd like you to put
absolutely.
That on.
Yes, please.
So I went through this. We were talking a lot about my process over the last week or so. I went through this period where I was not writing songs. It was a long enough time. I wasn't doing anything creative. It was a long enough span of time that I thought it was done. This is from February 2012 or 2011 to July of 2012. It was like the valve had just been shut off.
Yeah.
And I was going out with this really, really pretty woman and spending a lot of time at her house. And she had this guitar that was fucked up that you couldn't play it in standard tuning, because if you pushed any of the strings down, it would just make a metallic clinking sound instead of the notes. Mm-hmm. It needed the setup.
Yeah.
But I found that I could tune it in this way, this tuning that I had been playing with at home, and it was like this open tuning, and you could form chords, and I started learning where chords were on this guitar. And I started fooling around with it, and there's my friend Kit Wilson Yang in Canada had this song called White Glue, and it was I got white glue for the worst of it and a stapler to keep it organized. And I started singing that along with this little riff that I'm playing, and you know, she and I, the girlfriend and I, were breaking up, and it wasn't obvious to me. So we were still sleeping together.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't clear that we were coming to a close. I've never had a relationship end like that, where it ended even though you were still having sex.
Mm.
I'm sitting there, and she leans in singing this white glue for the worst of it. And she leans in from the other room and says, all you sing about is broken things. And it set this... I felt that muscle twitch somewhere in the brain. And I bet you know where this... I bet you know that feeling where you're like, holy cow. You know?
Yeah.
And then you're like, I gotta remember that. And then a couple of days later, I had this song finished. It's called For the Worst of It. And I wrote Kit and made sure she was okay that I use her lyric in something. And that was like the beginning of what we've gotten to today. I mean, that was 4.5 years ago. And then it was like the floodgate opened that I wrote now these, you know, half a record that I'm touring on right now. And then the other full record, which will be called Metal Is My Only Friend. So that's why I wanted to play that song, because we're talking about, you know, because that's somebody I met in Canada twice years ago. We're not really friends, you know, but she said something that affected me. And then 5 years ago, somebody I'm really not friends with said something that affected me, you know, while I was playing a guitar, you know, and then these things change you, you know.
Yeah.
And so you tend to think about these people that, you know, aren't in your lives, you know?
Yeah.
So you want to play it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I got white glue for the worst of it and a stapler to keep it organized. I got long drives to the upper right, and I make fast friends with Ontarians. But the police, their beat on me made my egress under dual rest. I got not dogs, it was not my dog. Trust in sleep deaf, former devilin. Of hard tea, fake meat, coup de gueule.
broken thing without some tricks up my sleeve to fix. Broken things without some tricks up my sleeve to fix. And I got white and blue for the worst of it.
All right, and so for people who want to own the worst of it, how do they do that? How do folks get on the Brooke Pridemore train?
You can go to a Bandcamp, Brooke Pridemore, B-R-O-O-K, P-R-I-D-E-M-O-R-E dot bandcamp.com, brookepridemore.bandcamp.com, and you can download, you can stream those songs for free. You can download them for a nominal fee, and you can order tangible product from me personally, and I will send them to you. They are also available on Spotify and on Apple. I found out I'm on Apple Music. I don't have an exclusive deal.
Oh my!
Somebody sent me a thing about Apple, a screen grab of one of my songs on Apple Music, and I had no idea. I had no idea I was on there. I guess there's this company that I work with that, you know, makes sure that I get paid for all that stuff. I get like $40 every 3 months, you know, for my YouTube and Spotify and Bandcamp and, or not Bandcamp, but all those streaming services. I don't have any real traffic, but... Yeah. You know, I get a couple of records, you know.
Yeah,
couple,
that's nice.
You know, I get a $40 payout.
Yeah.
You know, every couple of months I go buy a new metal double 12-inch or something, you know, and like go to the record store and splurge on something, you know. So it's helps you live.
Yeah, I have these designs of starting a tape label so I can just pay for my own habit. Like if I could just get to the point where I break even on music.
Sure.
You know, but so there's that. You have a Twitter, right, which is...
Yeah, Brooke Pridemore, B-R-O-O-K-P-R-I-D-E-M-O-R-E.
And you're saying the column, where is the column at?
Oh, it's on the Sympathizer. The Sympathizer is the website, and my column is called the Empathizer.
And I'll put links to all of this when, you know, it's posted on the thing. And I'll also embed some of these links in the MP3 tag when I make it.
Cool.
So, all right. So, on that happy note, it's time for the bottom five.
Okay.
All right. Bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready, Mr. Pridemore?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Number one, if you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night? Say the Earth is slowing down, is not spinning anymore. Would you hope, would they weren't sure, you know, are you going to end up in New York City, is going to be on the day side or the night side? Which would you prefer?
I would prefer to be on the night side.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Makes sense. Sun is annoying. Question two. What is your most irrational pet peeve? Is there anything that most people find... okay or not particularly annoying, but when it's done to you in your vicinity, you're like, I will fucking murder you in front of your children and make them watch.
There are a lot of...
This is a good start.
I have had to learn to not say, and that's the one thing I really can't deal with when, with regards to booking a show. Or with regards to this thing that I'm doing,
yeah.
There are a lot of little things that people either do because they are inept, or because they're trying to sabotage you in some little way. It all have to do with shows that just drive me up the wall. You know, when somebody goes, when you're the touring act and you get to town and you get, and they go, you don't mind playing last, right? And I go, I absolutely mind playing last. And I told you that in the emails.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, oh, because my drummer has to leave to get up early to go. And you got to literally, I've had to literally start going like, I don't give a fuck what your drummer has to do in the morning. This is punk rock, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's not okay.
Yeah.
And to kind of have people be like, wow. You know, and it'll be, and there's all kinds of little things like that that are all about the same amount of
annoyance.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Question three, and this might actually be related, considering the story you told about the Wars of It. Question three, out of the people who have seen you naked, how many do you never want to speak to ever again? What's the tally?
Only one. There's only one. And it's funny because we live in the same neighborhood.
Mm.
And anybody else I would be polite to.
Mm.
Hi, it's nice to see you. No, I'm not going to sit down. I got to go.
Mm.
You know. But only one would I cross the street to avoid.
I see.
Yeah.
All right, question four. Question four. This question has a scenario.
Okay.
If we were living in a dystopian future, okay, so whatever, society's collapsed, Trump did his business, right, it's over, civilization's done, and the new order was maybe very anti-literate and anti-information and anti-knowledge, and the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin. Hmm. Like, that's the rule. If it's bound in human skin, we'll keep it, anything else on the fire. Would you then say donate your skin, and what book would you donate your skin for? Like, so you're faced with this question, if I don't march myself off to the tannery with this tucked under my armpit, this is lost for forever.
Okay.
Would you make that choice, and if so, what book? And it's also got the caveat, you can't say the Bible, the Quran, or the complete works of Shakespeare. Okay. Somebody was on those. Somebody already got
them. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those were the first three taken.
Feels like the Bible, the Quran, the complete works of Shakespeare, and the Art of the Deal would probably be protected under Donald Trump.
I guess under this scenario,
it's easy to say president when you say it in quotes. The quotes are implied.
Yeah.
Yes, I would. And I would choose to protect a copy of Our Band Could Be Your Life.
Fantastic. Excellent choice. I think you've won this question.
That was our Bible in the car, in the old tour van. There was a copy. I've probably read that 30 times. I think anyone that you should not read on the road. I read On the Road 10 years after my first tour. Mm-hmm. I was very bored.
Yeah.
It's not a good book.
No.
But our Band Could Be Your Life is a very good book and should be preserved.
Yes.
And so I would donate my skin to preserve Our Band Could Be Your Life.
Great.
Yeah.
Final question. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Question five. If there is a hell and you end up there, name one celebrity that you expect / hope to meet.
I'm going to name two.
Okay.
I would expect / hope to meet Harry Nilsson.
That would be cool.
At the most, you know, at the most debaucherous Brandy Alexander party in hell. Brandy Alexander party in hell might be a good name for a psychedelic punk song.
Yeah.
And Brittany Murphy. Mm. Because I still feel a little sad about her death. Mm. And I would like her to know that she was loved when she was here, and she was maybe even loved a little more when she was, you know, before she got so weight conscious.
Yeah.
You know, I you know, thought she was perfect the way she was. You know, I wish she'd lived long enough to hear Born This Way, the Lady Gaga single.
Yeah.
You know. And I say that unironically. I really do. like when I think about the fat shaming culture, I think about, you know, somebody like her who thought she had to compete with, you know, people that probably weighed 10 pounds less than she did.
Yeah.
At most. And go, you know, it didn't have to be that bad. It yeah. didn't have to end that way.
Yeah.
So that's my answer.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
I think that's about it. So again, there'll be links to the Bandcamp, the tweet box, the column. So you're going to be touring again. This is the last day of this tour, yeah. but you're going to be touring again in April and September, correct?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there an ETA on the new record?
I want to find somebody. I would like to get somebody that would be willing to work this record. And I think it won't be a problem. I think once it's mixed, some people will hear it. Sometime mm-hmm. this year, I hope.
Okay.
Which probably means sometime next year. But
yeah, okay. You know. So 2017, maybe 2018.
Yeah.
But there's one in the can almost.
Yeah. yeah. And it's all recorded.
It's all recorded.
I'm going to play some of it for you on the drive. So you can hear it if you're interested.
I would fucking love to, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Cool. That's exciting. Then it'll be a tease, and I won't be able to hear it again for the thing, but that's all right.
That's keep them coming back.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something, maybe February 15th, 2017. Who knows? Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is, of course, on Facebook. Thanks to Brett, as always, for lovely theme music. Later, meets.